Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and with me on the other end of the phone line is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Good morning, everyone. Well,
we are speaking today with the writing team known as Audrey Blake. Caroline, do you want to tell our guests a little bit about them?
Well, I'll tell you, it's interesting to me that they can do this when they're thousands of miles apart, but I think it's amazing that they have produced this book, The Woman with No Name, and it's about a, oh gosh, what is it about? It's about a group in
The French Resistance of World War II.
Yeah, the French Resistance, and yeah. You know, we've had a lot of books about during World War II and things, and this one is probably the most interesting because it's the most unusual, to me anyway, that this could happen to these people. And oh golly, yeah, okay.
Audrey, that's an incredible compliment. Hey?
And Audrey,
I haven't enjoyed many World War II books.
Audrey Blake is the creative alter ego of writing duo Jama Fixon and Regina Saroy, two authors who met as finalists of a writing contest and have been writing together happily ever since. I really want to know more about that story.
Yes,
they share a love of history, nature, literature, and stories of unforgettable women. Both are prairie girls. Jama hails from Alberta, Canada, and Regina calls the wheat fields of Kansas home, as we've recently discussed. So welcome to Writer's Voices, Regina and Jama.
Thank you.
So first question, Audrey Blake, how'd you come up with that name? And why did you decide to write under a single name rather than just, you know, by Jama and Regina?
Well, if people see our names, neither of us have easy names to pronounce or spell or remember. So we both have somewhat, and neither one of us are an Ann Smith. So it was a marketing decision from Sourcebooks. They came to us and said, if you would be so kind as to choose a pen name to write under, something that people could easily remember, and they said it would also really help if it was near the beginning of the alphabet, because when new books come out, they're sent in alphabetical order, so the closer you are to the top, the better chance you have of librarians and bookstores catching sight of your books.
So, oh my gosh.
That's interesting.
Right? So my oldest daughter, her name is Audrey, and Jama's oldest son is named Blake. And so we combined our children and came up with our pen name.
Now, are your other children jealous?
No.
My son was kind of annoyed. He told me I really shouldn't have done it because he hadn't given me permission, but he didn't ask for permission before I named him Blake in the first place either.
Well, I named a company after my two grandchildren, taking the the first two letters of one's name and the last two letters of the other's name, and it became Lova.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
It's got a good sound to it. I like it.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. I think they kind of like it, even though they're, you know, now teenagers and maybe don't think it is quite as cool as they did when they were six or seven. But
Blake's 19 now. He's okay.
Okay. Yeah. You got to get through those rough years, right? Where everything you do is gets an eyeball roll. Now this is, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but is this the third book that you've written and published together?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about this writing contest, and how it brought you together. And the other thing I want to know is, how do you decide who's going to answer which question?
It helps if you ask exactly. us my name.
Okay. All right. Jema.
We alternate, but I love hearing Regina tell the story, but you're stuck with me this time. So there used to be this contest on Amazon called the Breakthrough Novel Award. It was like abbreviated as ABNA or something. And you know, if you had a book that you'd written, you could submit it, and it was like a survival style kind of thing. So start with like 5,000 entries, and they would whittle it down by the blurb, or like a 250 word pitch. And then, you know, you'd advance to the next level and they'd read like a chapter and so on and so forth. And so when it got down to 50 contestants remaining, like contestants and just the general public could read the whole manuscript as an ebook. And so I'd been reading other books, and I read Regina's, and it was just incredible. It's her novel On Little Wings. And I was like, okay, well, like, good job, Jema. You made it this far, but like, it's over. So I was able to like contact her via reviews. Like, we were able to leave online reviews for each other's work. And she answered back and she said she'd read my book. And I was, you know, floored and, you know, completely honored. And then we started emailing. And Regina will be modest when she tells the story and omit the fact that she actually won. But it really started a pretty incredible friendship, because by the time, you know, the dust settled of the contest, we were exchanging chapters of our next work, and we became critique partners. And yeah, it's pretty incredible that, like,
so random, but going from a critique partner to actually co-writing is a big step. So Regina, what caused you to, I mean, whose idea was it to take that step?
Well, Jema had come into town for a writing conference, and so we got an entire weekend together. We were having a great time. And I had been doing a lot of medical research and the history of medicine, and particularly the history of the discovery of anesthesia. And I was getting sucked in deeper and deeper. I don't think I have ever been so captured by one subject in my entire life. And I came to Jema and I told her, this has to be a novel. It has to be. It has everything that a reader would want. And I told her, I am so overwhelmed at the prospect of ever being able to do the proper amount of research. Like, this is more than one person could really do justice to. And she just immediately said, we'll do it together. She's like, I'm in, let's do it.
So, you didn't even have to stop and think about it, Jema?
No, we were
I said, not in first person. And she said, okay.
So we were in my living room and we sat down with some post-it notes that day, and that post-it note is still attached in my office right on my windowsill. I look at it every day, and it was our list of what would the names of our characters be. So right there I have all of our first discoveries of our names and that day that we started to discuss it. So we got to work right away, and I wasn't wrong about the research. The research was a complete joy because it was fascinating, but it took us so long before we could really put pen to paper and start making a story, because there was so much to learn.
And this became The Surgeon's Daughter?
That is actually the sequel to it.
Okay.
Yes, The Girl in His Shadow.
Okay. And so what year was that published?
Is that 21, Jema?
21?
Wow. I think 21. Yeah.
And when did you start? When did it start? When did you have this first meeting?
Wasn't that in 14?
I think 16.
16. It was a good 5 years of work.
Wow.
From when we began until it was published.
Wow.
Maybe it was published in 2020 because we first pitched it at a conference. I remember because like we were going to this conference and it was my 40th birthday. And so it was like girls' weekend. and we pitched it, which was like, if you've never pitched a novel like live to an agent, it is like one of the most truly horrifying, nerve-wracking experiences of your life. But it was awesome to do it like shoulder to shoulder with your friend. Like,
I bet. So how did you split up the work?
We're really bad at that.
So you both end up researching the same thing and then yes.
Yes. We had to. We both had to know the subject inside and out to do what we did. So there was no way that we could say, you research this type of surgery and I'll research anesthesia. We had to both become mini experts on whatever the book handled because we both wrote in that space. So yes, the research was pretty equal and we read the same books, essays, medical journals. Yeah.
So how did it save you time then? I mean, you said you did it because that you wanted someone else because the research would be too much for one person. But if you're both doing all the research, it just makes it more fun.
It didn't save time. It was more of a second check. It was that the research was so difficult to have a second pair of eyes on it. And to say, did I get that surgery correct, Jaima? Did I describe that musculature? And it was a second set of eyes. So it was kind of it was a too deep research project. So it helped to know somebody else would catch you if you made a mistake.
Ah, okay.
I wouldn't say that we necessarily like save time with our project, but we just have more resources to draw from.
Yeah.
With two. So, you know, if I have a scene and I start writing it and then I just get stuck, I can just leave it and Regina can pick up where I leave off.
Okay. You're listening to Writer's Voices and our guests today are Jaima Fixon and Regina Saroy, who together write as Audrey Blake and the author. The book that we're talking about today, although we haven't started talking about it yet, but the book we're going to be talking about today is A Woman with No Name. And it's a little bit different than what we've been talking about. So let's get into that. Caroline, do you want to start?
Well, I was interested in that this lady, this woman in the book is actually a real person. But not all the characters in the book are, but she was actually a real person. And how did you find that out? How did you discover that?
I've always had an interest in the history of resistance movements in the Second World War. I actually, like, you know, forever ago, selected that as my guided coursework project. As in the United States, I guess it would be a high school senior, grade 12 here. But and then I just kind of forgot about it. But then we were looking for, you know, a subject for a standalone historical novel. So we were reading pretty widely. We were looking, you know, kind of similar to our books about Nora Beattie, kind of medically adjacent things. But then we came across a mention of Yvonne Rudela in kind of a broader survey history of the resistance movement and the agents who were trained by SOE and deployed to France in particular. And her, like, she was maybe a paragraph in that book, but that paragraph was so interesting. We just wanted to know more about her.
Wow. So she was a French woman living in England who, as a middle-aged woman with a grown daughter, becomes the first woman to go undercover in France against the Nazis. Mm-hmm. That just seems, I mean, that's unbelievable.
I know. It seems impossible. Yeah, it does.
Jaima is the one that brought her to my attention. Jaima discovered Yvonne, and what really pulled me on board, because we had been discussing several different women that we might write about, and what captured me is when Jaima said that there was a middle-aged woman who was estranged from her husband. Her one child was grown. She lived all alone in a flat with her cat in London. And then during the London bombings, her apartment is flattened and she loses everything, including her cat. She makes it out with a suitcase with a few belongings that she gets from the rubble. And when she said that this woman lost even her cat and is just wandering down the rubbled streets of London, wondering what in the world to do with the rest of her life. And then she is somehow a year later recruited as the first undercover agent to create a resistance network in France. I thought, whatever that story is, we need to tell it. Because how does one go from where she was on that London street to the middle of France trying to defeat the Nazis? Whatever that arc was, I wanted to know it. And so I figured that so would readers. So Jaima was the one that sold this to me. And it for me, it was the cat. Her cat died, I was in.
Well, and I think the thing, as we were talking about, we had a lot of choices. Like, do we use elements of her story and combine her with other women to, I think sometimes there is, pressure, to write about someone young, to write about someone who has a very obvious love interest. Mm-hmm. And I think mm-hmm. Regina really guided us to the right decision in that Yvonne, in and of herself, like just of herself, was so fascinating and interesting and compelling. Like, we just didn't want to mess with her. We wanted to use her name. We wanted to have the details of her life portrayed as faithfully as we could. I mean, this is historical fiction. So all her kind of thoughts and things are our own guesses. But we tried to be as faithful to her story as we could.
So you had one paragraph to start with. How did you find out so much about what she actually did in France, and also about her life before?
We got a hold of one official biography that was written about her called Jacqueline. And that was, it's a well-written research. And then we were able to get a hold of historians in England who were able to get us a copy of her entire government file. And so,
you're kidding.
No,
wow.
So we see photocopied the actual copies and images of everything that she had on file with the British government. And we were also able to secure an interview with her granddaughter. And so it just slowly grew. As we kept searching and rooting out these sources, we were able to get closer and closer.
You must have gotten so excited when you
got
that file.
I did. I was up at midnight speaking to a British historian who was able to secure that for me, because of course we're off by several hours, and so I'd had to get up in the middle of the night to have the conversation to beg for her file.
Wow. So what did you learn anything in that file that surprised you?
Yes.
Jaima?
Yes. But in some ways, the impact of that wasn't so much informational as emotional. Like, just seeing the photographs of these papers that are with little notes scribbled in the margin. And I don't know, like the emotional impact of that was so powerful. Like it just, it's hard to explain, but like you kind of feel choked up, you feel inspired.
So Regina, what, when you said yes, what was it? Was there something in particular that you were thinking of?
For me, it was a lot, like she said, for me, it was reading the descriptions of her, right? That they, that they would have to write. It was reading her height. It was reading her age. I mean, she was 5'1". She didn't weigh 100 pounds. She was in her mid 40s. Which today we don't think of mid-40s as middle-aged, really, but we did. This was a time where that was different, right?
Right.
And so just reading the descriptions of her, every little note they made about her, I kept thinking, how is she going to go and blow up France? Like, what? How is this going to work? So for me, I felt like everything surprised me because it just made it so real, like Jaima was saying.
One of the things, I don't want to give away any spoilers. So even though it's a historically accurate, you know, a lot of the events actually happened, but was the, so I think it's safe to say that the Nazis actually had identified her and were looking for her at some point. Mm-hmm. And, but the reason that they knew what they were looking for, and that's what I don't want to give away, was that factual or was that something that you made up?
That we made up. Yeah. It's actually not known how they got her name and some of the other names of the people in her network. There's been like numerous criminal trials. No one's ever been convicted for that. There's a lot of theories, but nothing has been settled conclusively.
Okay.
So I was thinking, Jaima, that she was talking about the briefcase, which is completely factual.
Oh, I was actually talking about what she lost when she was blowing up the...
That we made up.
That you made up. Okay.
So, but there was truly a briefcase that was stolen that had all of the names, and the Germans had a lot more information than they let on for a very long time because they were using that to widen the net and pull people in so that they could close the trap.
So how could an agent have been stupid enough to put that information in an overhead compartment on a train and then fall asleep?
I don't know.
That's like, I mean, that would seem like that would be, you know, lesson one in spycraft, right?
But again, most of these people, you know, like weren't, you know, like some were trained as spies. A lot of the people were just recruited locally. So you were a car mechanic. You were, a manager of an electricity company. You were a chicken farmer. You were a hairdresser.
Yeah, that's true. Did they know who it was that lost it?
It was a man. His name is known. We didn't put it in because we didn't want to be untied.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Can you imagine you're risking your life working for the resistance and then doing something that stupid? That's like
even agents who were trained made horrendous mistakes sometimes. But yeah. You know, they were tired. You know, they were, you know, underfed. Like the average weight loss of a civilian living in France was like a ton at this time. Like, you know, everyone wasn't getting enough calories, like they weren't getting enough sleep. You know, it was just a really, really stressful time.
Now, was the leader of the French resistance in Tours, Flowers, was he an actual person? Yeah. And Was he as bad to was he as bad to Jacqueline as you portray him to be?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So whatever happened to him? He got recalled to London, and then what?
I believe he finished the war in England, didn't he, Jaima?
So I don't think he was ever deployed back to the field, but I think he did other work for the intelligence service but based in the UK is I believe, but you know, I might be wrong.
Yeah, we didn't follow him.
Yeah, he probably got a promotion.
I mean, the thing is that there was resistance at every level to having women engaged in this work.
Right.
Like even on your own side, in England, in France.
And yet, didn't women do some of the most important work in the resistance?
Because they weren't as suspected.
Right.
They could get away with more.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it was impossible for a young, healthy man to even be walking in the streets because they're not supposed to be there. They're suspect just by being there, right? Because
right.
they should have been in a work camp or in the army or something like that. So.
Mm-hmm. And you ended up with women leading entire networks. So in Yvonne's case, leading a network, Pearl Witherington, I think is her name. Maybe I'm getting it wrong, but you know, she, you know, led a whole network of like combat resistance. So, you know, women, like they found what they could do and they found what they could do, but it, you know, no one expected it of them. They expected them to do different work.
Right.
You know, Yvonne arrived in France. They just wanted her to be a courier, which was incredibly dangerous work.
And important.
And important.
Yeah.
And she did that, but she was also able to do much, much more.
Now, one of the other details that I'm wondering if it was something based on historical accuracy was her fear of water. Was that really true?
Yeah, her father really did die from a flood of the Seine. He didn't drown, but the water was so cold it gave him pneumonia and he was killed that way. And so she did have a fear of water growing up.
And in this training, so the organization, it's the SOE, what does that stand mm-hmm. for?
Special Operations Executive.
And that's in England. Mm-hmm. And they were training people specifically to go undercover in France and other countries. So how were you able to research what the training was like?
There's some amazing resources about that.
Did you have to go visit a training camp in England, for example?
Doesn't still exist. So Ian Fleming, who wrote the James Bond books, he was trained at the same camp that Yvonne was. And so that whole genre of the special operations spy that is from the same places. But they do there was actually a documentary show that was put onto Netflix that recreated some of the training of the SOE camps for the men and the women. So we got to see real life people actually doing some of the same challenges that Yvonne did.
Wow. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's like a great like reality TV in like a whole new...
That's for sure. That's for sure. Would one of you like to read a little bit from the book for us?
Sure. Prologue. Paris, 12th of August, 1928. Maman, tu ne le connais pas. Mother, you don't know him. Silence on the line. I hugged the receiver to my ear, curling against the telephone niche built into the wall. Still nothing, so I glanced down the hall at my daughter, Jacqueline, sitting quietly in the salon,
She was small for six, even tinier folded up in the great armchair, a book spread on her lap. Slowly she turned a page. Damn, she was listening. I strode as far as the cord allowed and pushed at the door with an outstretched foot. It swung most of the way shut. An exasperated sigh filtered down the line. I said the same thing to you, Yvonne, but you were determined to marry him. Yes, but... I bit my lip. My mistake. A wife belongs with her husband. You've been away long enough. You must go back to London. Alex doesn't want me. And here, in Paris, Henri did. My life had luster again, except when I spoke with my mother. Yvonne, it's been months, and you spend all your time running about with that man. Your husband will know. So? Alex didn't hide his feelings for the widow across the street. I want a divorce. Your husband will never agree to that. He'll have to if I stay in France. And you think Henri will marry you? He wants to, I retorted, but I have to lose Alex first. It will never work. She'd said the same thing about my marriage. I'm not... A car horn hooted cheerily from outside. My heart jumped. I have to go, Mother. Yvonne! Bye! I wasn't six anymore. I set down the receiver and reached for a new ivory cloche trimmed with wide brown ribbon. Jacqueline, get your coat! In the mirror, I inspected the diagonal fall of my skirts. Mummy? I answered in English, sensing this wasn't the time to argue about speaking French. Eventually, she'd tire of people not understanding her. What is it? We're in a hurry, Jacqueline. I miss Daddy. Can't we go home? I turned round and found myself confronting a miniature Alex, complete with folded arms and frown. I took a moment to collect myself. I crouched down and picked up Jacqueline's hands. They were small and quick, like my own. He doesn't want us, I said quietly. I know it's hard, but... She blinked twice, her lips pursing. He wants me. I know he does. This was no time to point out that it had been 6 weeks since he'd sent her a letter. We both love you very much, pet. Let's talk about it later. We can't let our worries spoil our drive, not on such a beautiful day. I guided her arms into her coat, worried she'd refuse. Henri was wonderful with her, but it was natural for her to be standoffish. In time, she'd warmed to him, but for now, I didn't want to keep him waiting. Quickly, love. She tugged her knitted cap onto her head and stomped outside. Darling, how are you? Henri called to me. As usual, Jacqueline was ignoring him, climbing into the back seat of the open-top car with as much enthusiasm as she'd show for a trip to the dentist. I adjusted the angle of my hat and smiled up at Henri, kissing both his cheeks. Trouble? He asked in an undertone. It's nothing, I said. What do you say to an ice cream, Jacqueline? Henri asked, helping me into the car. Right sort of day for it, no? My name's Jackie, she reminded him. At least she'd replied in French. Henri didn't speak English. That's just what your schoolmates called you, I said. You'll have new friends and a new nickname this year. Jacqueline scowled at her knees. Definitely ice cream, Henri said, shifting the car into gear. Hold tight, Jackie. He took the corner at speed, earning laughs from both of us. Standoffish or not, Jacqueline loved going for a drive, especially when Henri put a little thrill in it. We left the suburbs and whizzed through Maison Lafitte, the town where I'd been raised, and tore down roads walled on both sides by impenetrable masses of green, the forest of Saint-Germain. What's for lunch? I asked. Bread, pâté, brie, and tomatoes for you, darling, since I know you don't like it. Some pears, a very nice bottle of Chardonnay, and a ginger beer for Jacqueline, Henri said. A plum tart tatin, which I think you will like, and a thermos of coffee. Sounds wonderful, I said. There's a turn a kilometer or so away, Henri said. We'll take the footpath into the woods until we find a place to picnic. Then, after we sleep off lunch, we can walk back to the car and, on the way home, find our ice cream. He grinned at me. I returned the smile, then glanced back at Jacqueline. That sounds perfect, doesn't it? What kind of ice cream? Jacqueline asked, still needing convincing. Whatever you like, Henri promised grandly. From what they have in the shop, I amended and turned my attention to the scenery. Help me watch, darling. I don't want to miss the turn, Henri said, passing me a well-used map without taking his eyes from the road. I unfolded it awkwardly, struggling to keep it from flapping in the breeze. We rocketed down a straightaway. Maybe slow down a little, I said. This thing is going to fly away, or smack me in the face. Other way up, darling, Henri said. Yes, I know. Just give me a merde. I slammed into the dash as Henri stomped on the brakes. A deer bounded off the road and into the trees. The back of the car fishtailed, swinging right, left. No, I shouted as we veered toward the edge of the road. The car didn't hear me, skidding inexorably and spraying up gravel. Hold on, Henri shouted. I twisted to reach Jacqueline and found myself hurtling through the air. I crashed to the ground and lost my breath in a shatter of glass. Yvonne? I lifted my head, spotted Henri on my right, crawling through high grass over a loose tire. Jacqueline, I gasped soundlessly. Henri bent over me, his hands hovering anxiously. Are you all right? Where's Jacqueline? This time he heard me and scrambled up to his feet. I seized his hands and hauled myself up. The car was at least 10 meters away from us, upside down, stopped by a thick stand of trees. Jackie! I lurched forward, desperate for a sight of her blue cap. Jacqueline! Henri was faster on his feet. My legs weren't obeying. She's here, he called, bent at the back of the car. She's... I staggered closer and saw her, beneath the car, with blood on her skirt and her blue knit sweater. Breath left me in a rush, and I sank to the ground, gathered up her limp form, with arms that felt like ribbons, choking on each breath. Baby, baby, I sobbed. Please, please, please.
And that was Jama Fixon from the writing team Audrey Blake, reading from The Woman with No Name. So what is the actual writing process like for the two of you? Now, I think Jama mentioned that if she gets stuck on a scene, you might pick it up and finish it. Is it really, like, are you working off the same document?
We are. So we have a joint document, and what happens is we'll discuss what needs to be written next in the story and just kind of divvy it up according to interest, who was really interested in writing what. And we both just dive in and write. And then if I write a scene, she'll come in the next day and look it over, and she'll just go through and make all of the changes that she would make. And then I'll go through it again, and we just polish it up. So our hands are in each other's work. If you imagine like cooks in a kitchen, it's one pot, and we're both throwing the ingredients in and stirring and testing it. And we just work in unison on everything that we do.
Do you ever disagree?
We do. I would say that our first book, we disagreed the least. Like as we got into it, the first book was so, so exciting for both of us to have a partner there. Now when we disagree, it usually just comes down to why are we disagreeing? We'll both put out our supports for why we want to do something a certain way. And if we still disagree after that, which is pretty rare, then it comes down to who cares the most. So if I don't like that idea, but it's not life-changing to me, then, and Jama feels very, very strongly about it, we'll do it Jama's way, and vice versa. If it matters deeply to me, and she says, well, I wouldn't do it that way, but I don't seem to care as much as you do, then we'll do it my way.
Understood. Caroline, do you have some questions?
Well, I was interested in the fact that she was, the heroine was proficient in explosives when she came into this. And that was interesting. Is that why the men that were already there, is that why they were so jealous of her, because she could do that?
So Caroline, why Raymond Flower hated her so much? There's no explanation for it. There's no reason for it. He was a highly paranoid and suspicious person by nature, just highly. And he decided he didn't trust Yvonne to the point that he was willing to have her killed. He thought that she was a threat to the network, and he was willing to have her killed. Most of the men in the network, when they saw her expertise in explosives, were happy to have an expert in explosives. There wasn't that strong jealousy. Most of them were just glad to have someone who knew what they were doing and had the supplies to do it and would be able to show them. So although Raymond Flower was just a piece of work, there were men that didn't show the same amount of jealousy. They were they were quite willing to learn from whoever had the knowledge to teach them.
It seemed like at first they were dubious about it. They didn't think it was possible that she could be that, you know, proficient.
I think dubious is the perfect word. Yes, dubious is a great word, right? In walks this 100-pound middle-aged woman, and she says, "I can show you how to blow up these trees and take out this road." And they probably thought, "Can you really?" Right? So dubious, I think, is a great word.
Wow. Did her daughter never knew that she was in France, right? Until after the war. And she did actually survive the war, but not much longer after that. So she never got to see her daughter again, correct? Wow.
No.
Yeah, that's really sad. Were the, you know, kind of the part of her downfall or how she got captured had to do with some Canadian soldiers that were sent in? Were they real historical mm-hmm. people? And they just were not well, I mean, it's not that they weren't well trained, but they were easy to spot. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, they spoke French. That didn't sound French.
Probably French Canadian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, even within France, there's regional accents. And, but at this point, you know, the powers that be in London were just sending everyone they could, whether it was wise or not. So
oh, wow.
They were sending agents into France that they're kind of grading on the scoring system like Yvonne had, like, you know, what are your skills? What are your things? They were sending people that the instructors had, you know, serious reservations about. But they were just sending.
But why would they do that when it would put the good ones at risk?
I know.
It's what they had to work with, right? It's what they had to work with. The two Canadian men that went in were good men, and they were skilled soldiers, and they were brave men. And what happened to them was just a tragedy, because it wasn't their fault. They were being sent into a situation where they couldn't win. They were going to get found out quickly.
Yeah, that's a shame. That's like, boy, people make mistakes at every level, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Doing the research, we really discovered that, like, mistakes at every level. And sometimes they got lucky and got away with it, and sometimes not.
Right? It's messy to run a war when you can't communicate, right? It's messy enough to run a war when you can, but behind the lines, the only way that they had to communicate were secret messages through radio operators who were being hunted. Your lifespan as a radio operator behind enemy lines was 6 weeks, I think.
Wow.
I think it was about 6 weeks was your life expectancy. So when you're literally being hunted with every communication you make, and every communication you make has to be heavily coded, how in the world do you keep on top of everything? How do you know who's been captured, who's been compromised, who's been killed, who you have to still work with? It was just a nightmare.
Wow. I think it's chaotic to run a war no matter what. But in those circumstances, it's hard to imagine. Was there some things that you learned that you found really fascinating, but they didn't make it into the book?
Mm-hmm. We cut a lot from this one.
Give me some examples of that.
Her husband didn't realize, or her, you know, estranged husband didn't realize she was gone until, like, she'd been in France for several months.
Oh, wow.
And I guess it wasn't uncommon for, you know, them to, like, go months without contact. It's a war. But, yeah, so, you know, people didn't notice she was gone for, like, quite a long time.
Wow. Now, when she was in training, did she have any contact?
Just died in a bombing raid.
Did she, when she was in training, did she have any contact with her daughter? She, but not, but didn't tell her where she was. Right.
Yeah. I believe, Regina, correct me if I'm wrong, she was able to see her or phone her in the few days she had leaving training before going to France. Maybe it was just a phone call.
I think it was a phone call.
Yeah. What are some other things that you had to cut out?
We had to cut out, well, actually huge amounts of it. There were a lot of her life before, like how they were actually able to find her, to recruit her. We had to really, for timeline purposes, cut a lot of that out. But she would quite openly tell people, before she had ever been contacted by the government, just from her own wild imagination, she would tell people, I'm going to parachute into France and join the resistance. Now, this is before she had any place anywhere. Like, you would just think it's kind of the ramblings of somebody who's just telling stories. But then it happened. Like, she would tell people, I'm going to go work for the government. I'm going to parachute into France. And then, well, she didn't parachute, but then she did. Like,
yeah.
how that came about when it was really just so far-fetched, I think is pretty shocking.
She was manifesting, and it totally worked.
Well, it sounds like she didn't really live by the rules in much of her life.
No.
Yeah.
No, she did not.
And now her mother was in Paris. And did she survive the war?
Yes,
she did.
She did.
Wow. I wonder what she was like. Because to have raised a daughter like that, she probably had some idiosyncrasies herself.
Yvonne was so freewheeling, right? In a day when it was not popular, she was a vegetarian practicer of yoga. Like, this isn't the 70s, this is the 40s. She was decades ahead of her time, but her mother was incredibly stern, exacting, demanding. So she used to punish Yvonne by making her sit still without slouching for hours at a time on a wooden board. So her mother was just very different than who she was.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
You're listening to
maybe
writers.
That's why...
Oh, go ahead, Mom.
I was going to say, maybe that's why she was so right. Off the rails, because she was, you know, she had to do the opposite when she was growing up. So she decided, I'm going to do my own thing here.
Right.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guests today are Jema Fixon and Regina Saroy, who write together as Audrey Blake, and the book is The Woman with No Name. And why that title?
I mean, we aren't really good at choosing titles. So it's kind of what the editorial team at our publisher at Sourcebooks.
Okay. Did you, you must have had a working title. What was your working title?
The Saboteur.
Oh, mm-hmm. I like that.
I think the reason why The Woman with No Name is, like, why we both, when we heard it, said that we really liked it, even though it's not what we had thought of, is because Yvonne went through so many names. And at the end of her life, even as she was dying, the people that were the closest to her that were trying to save her life didn't know her name, right? To them, she was Jacqueline. To some of them, she was Jacqueline with a different last name. And she had gone through several last names since getting into France. And they didn't even know she was Yvonne. Like, she gave up everything for this cause, including her own identity and her own name. So that's why I think it's a powerful title.
The other thing, wearing the same clothes day after day after day, was that really that, why, with all the things they were parachuting in, all the supplies, why wouldn't they send her some clothes? Or, I mean, she had money, why didn't she go buy some something.
This was something that like was just interesting to us. And at one point our editor was like, why do you keep talking about this? And he was like, well, because she did. She was complaining about it a lot. Like, you know, it was really risky to be radio in London. And she'd be like, please send me some more clothes. I have one set of underwear. Please send me some more clothes. I just never did. I'm like,
yeah.
Like, what's your problem? You know, she couldn't really just go buy it because there wasn't anything to buy.
Mm. Right. And there were people that were around her did give her some clothes. In fact, when she was captured wearing somebody else's clothing that she had borrowed. But one, it was difficult to find clothes that fit her. She was tiny, like just diminutive, and so it was difficult for other women to even have anything that could be tailored to her size.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine living in a time where there's nothing available.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go into a shop and buy something because there's no cloth, there's no way to get it. Yeah, it's almost unfathomable.
There's no cloth. There's no leather. Like, people are making shoes out of leather and rope, or out of wood and rope. And
oh my!
And in fact, women risk their lives using the parachute silk for clothing, for underwear, for undershirts, for even clothing. But if they were captured with that particular type of silk, then the Germans knew that somehow they were involved with the parachute drops, and they would be killed. They'd be interrogated until killed. And to actually help save people's lives, that's why the British government switched all of the parachute silk from white to an ugly khaki brown. They were trying to keep people, especially women, from being tempted to use it to make shirts, blouses, underwear, and make it very recognizable so they wouldn't be tempted to use it and get caught.
Oh, wow.
I
found it really interesting that when they would get the parachute drops, they would bury all the silk.
Mm-hmm. But, right, and that would have hurt. It would have just hurt your heart when you needed it so badly.
And yeah, to be able, to have to stay in that area long enough to bury it all was adding to the risk too, because obviously you can't drop parachutes through the sky without it being visible from a distance, and who knows who saw it and reported it and how long it would take for them to show up. And it was all just so very risky.
I wish that we could say that their only real enemies that they were watching out for were the Germans. But there were a lot of French traders that turned on their own people, This was times of war, and they were starving and they had nothing. And if someone offered you a nice juicy chicken and special, you know, and gave you excuses from work detail, and if you would just turn people in, there were a lot of people that were tempted by that and did that. So they didn't know who to trust on any side.
Wow. So we only have a few minutes left, and I'd like to go back to what we're talking about at the beginning, which is how the two of you got together and this writing contest. I'm curious what happened. What were the novels that you were writing individually, and what happened to those books? So, Regina, you want to go first for that contest?
Do you mean for the contest?
Yeah.
I wrote a young adult novel called On Little Wings, and that novel ended up winning the contest, and it was published through Penguin.
Wow. And have you done any other young adult novels?
Yes, I have. I have published some of my own works, and then the last 4 years, Jaima and I have been writing nonstop. And so my projects, I haven't picked up any of my own personal projects in the last 4 years, but I've been kept very, very busy with what we've been doing.
And Jaima, what was your novel that made the final 50 of that contest, right?
Mm-hmm. That one I've never published. It's also YA, but it's historical. It's about the Pythagoreans in classical Greece, which is like a math cult. So,
yeah. Oh, that
it's
sounds
still
interesting.
On my hard drive.
Do you think you'll ever return to it?
Well, probably not. It's been so long. After that, I self-published some Regency romances that were like super fun to write. But lately, I'm writing crime fiction for my personal project. So I have a book coming out from Sourcebooks, which is also our publisher, is Audrey Blake, October 15th. It's called The Specimen, and it's based on the Burke and Hare murders in Edinburgh in the 1820s.
Oh, wow. So what is your background, Jaima, before or in addition to writing?
I am an occupational therapist, so I maintain a small private practice of in community pediatrics, so supporting children with disabilities and their families here in Edmonton.
Okay, and how about you, Regina?
So I was a stay-at-home mom when I started writing the novel on Little Wings, but my schooling, I majored in history and I minored in creative writing. So it was always the plan to write historical stories and fiction for me. So I just studied history and was reading. And as soon as my oldest child went to kindergarten, and my second child was taking naps, I just spent every minute that she was napping in her bedroom at my keyboard. So I'd put my laptop on my lap in the rocking chair and I would type until she woke up.
Well, that's dedication.
I would say that was her first lullaby. Like she learned to fall asleep to the sound of a keyboard.
Now, do any of your children read your books, and what do they think?
My girls read my books and read our joint books, and they love them.
How about you, Jaima? Your kids are obviously old enough to read these, so do they get into it?
My daughter, Ivy, reads them, and she's, you know, kind of an early reader. I get her to, like, give me feedback. She has a lot of insight, so I really value her critique. My sons, not so much. Even my husband, he, like, only reads grit lit and nonfiction. But he did read The Woman with No Name in a week, which is, like, really, like, unusual for him, so.
Now, was it challenging to find a publisher for the joint books? Or because, Regina, you had already published on Little Wings, did that make it easier? Or
it didn't make it any easier, but no, it wasn't hard. We have the world's best agent. She's incredible, and her agency is incredible. And she took on our project, and on her first go-around try, she got our book in front of three competing publishers who all wanted it. So it actually went to auction. So
wow.
it was a
oh my goodness.
Great experience for us.
Well, congratulations for that. So we're out of time. I want to thank you both, Regina and Jaima, for being with us today. And Caroline, do you have some final words for us?
Well, this was in the book. It was Winston Churchill on October 29th in 1941 said, this is the lesson, never give in, never give in, never, never, never. And that was, I think, meant for the people that were trying to help him. And I think that's They were listening.
Yvonne never gave in, that's for sure.
That's for sure.
Well, see you all next week on Writer's Voices, and thank you both for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.